You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Parents are now playing more of a teacher role after the coronavirus pandemic shut down most schools around the country. Coming up, we'll look at some of the challenges and opportunities that's creating for parents, students, and teachers. Right now, saying thank you to someone can feel good, and research shows doing it a lot can be tied to a happier state of mind. But our motives for showing gratitude can make a difference. Our next guest says that thinking of gratitude as a self-help tool may not be the best way to go, but by showing thankfulness with other people in mind, it can come back to us in the form of stronger relationships and social groups. David Craig is a doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at The Ohio State University, studying positive emotions like gratitude, spirituality, and forgiveness. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much, Rob. This is the most social interaction I've had all week, so it's good to be here.
Well, that's fantastic. I'm glad I could keep you busy. People have been studying gratitude for a while now. Can you talk about some of the positive outcomes that gratitude can bring about?
Sure. So first thing I want to do is just distinguish between correlational research and then experimental research. So with correlational research, we're just looking at whether having more of one trait is associated or correlated with having more of another trait. And so in terms of correlational research, there's been a wealth of studies showing that people who report feeling gratitude more often or expressing gratitude more often have a greater level of positive emotions like optimism, joy, happiness. They have a lower incidence of mental health problems like depression, anxiety, and substance abuse. They report greater quality relationships. They report that they're more forgiving, and they even report sleeping better, surprisingly. That said, the experimental work, which actually tries to take individuals and then have them actually engage in gratitude practices and exercises, that literature has been a bit more murky. And in fact, a recent meta-analysis that my advisor and I did showed, for example, that these gratitude interventions or exercises actually have a fairly negligible impact on depression and anxiety. So there's kind of a breakdown, I guess you could say, between the correlational work in this area and then actually trying to bottle it and turn it into a self-help tool.
So it could be that if I'm a person who's very thankful and often expresses gratitude, it might just be part of the bundle of the other stuff that you just mentioned, those the positive outcomes, the positive attitude and things like that. It may be that causes that, or they might not cause each other. They might just be associated with the same type of person. Do I have that right?
Absolutely, yeah. So we don't exactly know why people who are more grateful have all these other traits that are associated with flourishing. As you said, it could just be that they're just more positive people in general. It could be maybe they tend to be more outgoing and they're more verbal with their expressions of gratitude. And so people just want to be around them more. And so they build up resources that way. So we don't exactly know exactly why it is. And that's why you often hear that correlation does not mean causation.
So now if I'm a what's in it for me kind of person, I might hear that and say, okay, I'm not going to get necessarily anything out of thanking people. So why bother?
Yeah, great question. So first thing I should say is that the one exception to the gratitude intervention research that I've seen is for relationship qualities. So that is the one finding I've come across where there is actually some strong evidence that when you, let's say, write a letter of thanks to someone, that it does improve your relationships with individuals. But I would still say that you should be careful with approaching a gratitude exercise with this sort of expectation in mind that it's going to benefit you in some way. Because recent work from our lab with my advisor, Jennifer Chevins, has shown that when individuals are expressing gratitude for the explicit purpose of trying to be happy, that it can actually backfire and they actually end up feeling less meaning in life among other well-being measures compared to individuals who just express gratitude freely without any expectation of benefit. So that's basically a long-winded way of answering your question and of saying that if you're trying to express thanks because you think it's going to help you, it might actually undermine your well-being and backfire in some ways, and probably best to steer away from that sort of motivation.
Talking to David Craig from The Ohio State University, looking at the psychology of gratitude, what it is, who benefits from it. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Do you make a point of thanking people for whatever? Does it make you feel good? Do you think it makes them feel good? Have you made a conscious effort to express thanks to others? Call 800-642-1234. Well, David, let's flip it around. Instead of thinking of what's gratitude going to do for me when I express it, do we have experiments on what it does to the people who receive the gratitude, on what it does to the people who are thanked?
Absolutely. So, this area is starting to burgeon a bit, although it's still probably not as well-developed as the research looking at what gratitude does for us. In typical American fashion, right, we start with what's this going to do for my happiness? But researchers are starting to look at how expressing gratitude can actually impact the person who is receiving it. So, for example, some of the work of Sarah Algo at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill looked at when you express gratitude towards close others, like romantic partners, for example. And then she has shown with her colleagues that when you express gratitude to a romantic partner or a friend, that it actually improves the level of relationship satisfaction of the person you're expressing it to. And it also improves your level of sort of social connection or perceptions of intimacy with that person. But then also they found that it also improves relationship connection and satisfaction for the person who is expressing gratitude. And so, again, we come back to that idea that really with gratitude, relationships seems to be the one thing that it seems to be really robust for.
Well, it seems like it might be hard to measure one outcome of this, and that's for a community of people, say a group of friends or a workplace where you might be paying in some gratitude that bounces back and benefits you later. It seems like that would be really hard to take and do a simple, reproducible psychology kind of study.
Absolutely. I mean, that is one of the major limitations of psychology, is we often are studying phenomena at the individual level, whereas we often are interested in generalizing our findings to community-level patterns. But in order to have a well-controlled study to actually look at a whole community, it would probably take a lot of money and a lot of scientists working together. So if there's any funders out there listening to this, please give me several million and I will make that happen.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in the town of Dunn. John, hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, along the lines of expressing thankfulness and so forth, what does your guest have to say about if the type of person that just says, boy, I'm thankful, to a whole group of people that are maybe discussing COVID-19 and they say, well, I'm so glad I haven't got that. I'm not talking to anybody in particular, but what does that have to do with this series?
So you're saying thankfulness about our current state in life, John, as opposed to thanking a particular person for a thing? Do I have that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So just, I guess, expressing thanks to the universe for good things happening to us, David, or bad things not happening to us. Do we have research on that?
Sure. So this is actually something I looked at a little bit in my recent meta-analysis that I did with my advisor, Jennifer Chevins, where we looked at differences between what we called interpersonal gratitude interventions, where you're, say, writing a letter of thanks to a specific person, and then intrapersonal gratitude interventions where you're not really expressing thanks to anyone in particular, like, say, keeping a gratitude diary or a gratitude journal, which I'm sure many listeners have heard of. We actually didn't find a difference in the effectiveness between the two. And as far as I've seen from other meta-analyses and other review papers, there hasn't really been consistent evidence that expressing gratitude to one particular person is better than just kind of expressing it kind of in general. Now, I will say the one exception to that I've seen is some work coming out of Harvard Medical School, David Rosmarin. They did a correlational study, so there's some limitations there, but they looked at religious gratitude versus kind of general gratitude, and they found that gratitude toward God or a higher power was more powerfully associated with well-being than kind of general gratitude without having that sort of direction towards a higher power or God.
We're talking to David Craig right now, doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at Ohio State, and we're looking at what research shows us about gratitude and the benefits it can have. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your own maybe personal story about gratitude in your life. What has showing gratitude done for you? How about receiving a thank you from others? Do you feel like it helps your mental health, your mood? Does it strengthen relationships? And do you have a method to your gratitude? Do you keep a gratitude journal or have some other formal way of making sure you thank people? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about showing gratitude and the benefits it can have. David Craig is with us, doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at Ohio State. He's sharing what research does and doesn't tell us about gratitude. And you could join in with your own story at 800-642-1234. Have you made it a point to show thankfulness to people in your life more often? Do you feel like it helps you? Does it help you and other people thank you for stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to your calls now. Desiree is with us in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yes, hi. I'm so glad actually to hear this talk. I tune in all the time through the show anyway. But I've been keeping a gratitude journal this year, and I've noticed a big difference. I suffer a lot with depression, and by me taking the time out, and you know they say it takes 21 days to make a habit, and I've been doing this now since the beginning of this year, and I have noticed a significant just a whole adjustment in my attitude, the way I feel. I actually look forward to that time, that few minutes of just writing what I'm thankful for throughout the day. And even if it's small things, it just makes such a big difference. It really does. It makes a big difference in the way that you feel, your attitude, and your whole outlook.
Desiree, thank you so much for sharing that. So a gratitude journal, she has this habit of doing it every day. David, I don't know, do we have that kind of long-term research on what something like that could do for a person?
Sure. So a couple of things I should mention here. So with the meta-analysis that I conducted with my advisor, you have to keep in mind that we're always looking at average effects. So in other words, we're saying that on average, this intervention has this sort of effect for the average person. But that doesn't mean that the findings are always going to apply equally to all people in all situations. So what we found in our research was that gratitude journals have a, well, let me back up. They're better than doing nothing at all. So when we compared them to a wait list, meaning participants who did nothing at all, these gratitude interventions like journals and gratitude letters actually have a medium-sized effect. But then when we compare them to any sort of control condition like writing about your route to work, we found that they have a rather small effect. So they seem to be better than doing nothing at all, but they have a more kind of a minimal effect when you compare it to a control condition. But again, we're talking about findings on average here. So I'm never going to say that doing these sort of gratitude journals are not helpful. I think if it's working for you and it's helpful, by all means, continue to do it. We just would say that on average, it's not going to be as helpful as, say, something like cognitive behavioral therapy, if that makes sense.
Desiree, thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm glad it's offering some benefit to you. Let's go now to Jeff with us in Winneconne. Jeff, hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Jeff?
Hi. I just, the way I perceive gratitude, I just wanted to mention it, is that it's almost, for me, a byproduct of how I'm living my life and the way I'm treating people and things around me. And I use it as a gauge. And like, if all of a sudden I'm sensing or feeling like I'm not grateful about things, or I'm speaking to people in a non-grateful way, I need to check what's going on inside of me, the way I'm behaving. What am I doing that my gratitude is going down? So I think it's like good manners. Yes, it's a behavior, but for me, it's more than that. It's like a gauge or a byproduct of how I'm living my life.
Well, and Jeff, if I can ask, when that gratitude gauge drops to zero, do you know what to do with that? Do you have ideas on how to get to that deeper stuff you see?
Yeah, definitely. For me, it comes from spiritual practices. It comes from responsible living. It comes from, I have very specific things that I do for, I guess, you know, to cope, or mental health, if you will. Do I need to go on a long walk with my best friend? Do I need to spend more personal time? Am I working too much? Am I balanced? Where's my balance at?
Interesting, like that. Jeff. That's super. That's fascinating, Jeff. Thanks for sharing that. So, David, Jeff sees the correlation, but he sees maybe the causation going the other way. If he's not being grateful enough, it's a red flag for him that he needs to do some more of the basic stuff.
Sure. I mean, that goes back to what we talked about kind of at the start of this show, which is that gratitude is correlated with a lot of other things like positive emotion and so forth. And so it could be that when individuals are feeling more positive and more happy, that they're already just kind of more naturally inclined to expressing gratitude, whereas when they're feeling more depressed or anxious, that, you know, it may be more difficult. And so that lack of gratitude could absolutely be an indication that, hey, maybe something's not going well in my life and I need to take a step back and think about, you know, how I can readjust some things.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to David Craig from The Ohio State University, looking at gratitude, taking your stories about how you express thanks and what it does for you to thank or be thanked. And David is sharing some of the research, the psychological research out there, about what we know about the benefits and the gray areas when it comes to gratitude. Back to your calls now. Troy is on the line in Appleton. Troy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to express the idea of me, myself, being a supervisor and having individuals that if I show gratitude to the fellow employees or people, that my productivity of them goes up.
Interesting. Okay. Troy, thanks a lot for sharing that. David, do we have research out there in workplace settings when it comes to the gratitude that Troy shares with his crew?
You know, I would have to look into that, but I would be betting that there has been some sort of study done on that. There's a whole field called industrial organizational psychology, or IO psychology for short, where they look at interventions done in the workplace and how to boost employee morale and boost employee productivity and so forth. And actually, a lot of the positive psychology theories and research that gratitude sort of grew out of have been heavily adopted by the IO psychology community. So I would have to look it up, but I would be willing to bet that someone has looked at that. I would guess that expressing gratitude to your employees would, in fact, have an effect on improving workplace morale and so forth.
Thanks again for that call. So, David, it sounds clear that we could use more research on gratitude. What are some of the big mysteries, the unanswered questions that you would really like to have some serious lab work done on to figure out?
Yeah, so, the first thing that I'm interested in continuing to look at is this idea of the motivations we bring to gratitude. So we've really seen this kind of a cottage industry pop up where gratitude is being promoted as a self-help tool to improve our own happiness and well-being. And I wonder if in some ways that really does send the wrong message, that gratitude is something we do to benefit ourselves rather than just something we do as a freely given gift. And so I'm curious to continue to run experiments to see when we kind of manipulate people's expectations or motivations for expressing gratitude, does that have an impact on well-being? I would also like to see some work on incorporating gratitude into currently existing evidence-based psychotherapies like cognitive behavioral therapy. So, you know, just because we found that gratitude interventions as standalone tools aren't especially effective, that doesn't mean that they couldn't perhaps supplement or add on to improve currently existing therapies. And then finally, I talked about this a little bit earlier, but I think there needs to be a lot more research done into the different types of gratitude. So I mentioned, for example, spiritual or religious gratitude versus kind of just general gratitude. And there's some early evidence coming out of Harvard showing that there are differences there. And in fact, there's an initiative that's just started up by Robert Emmons at the University of California, who's one of the sort of grandfathers of gratitude research. And they're looking at gratitude to God and what effects that has in terms of well-being and health. So there's some interesting scientific questions definitely to sink our teeth into.
So while there's still a lot of research to be done, how about this statement? Tell me if this makes sense. If I'm going to thank somebody else, I'm maybe better off thinking that I'm doing it for them, not thinking I'm doing it for myself. Is that fair at this stage to say?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think, Viktor Frankl was a famous physicist or psychiatrist who actually survived the Holocaust camps, and he wrote a whole book called Man's Search for Meaning. But he has a great statement in there where he says that happiness is and must always be a byproduct of a life well lived, basically. And so I think the same could be said of gratitude, that gratitude should be something, I think, where we do it just freely because we value it for its own sake. And then the happiness and the improved relationships and all those other things might just be a nice sort of side effect or byproduct.
And briefly, as we wrap up, David, do you take your work home with you? Does your research inform the way you behave when it comes to gratitude?
I do try to write gratitude letters to family, friends, and express gratitude to my wife. I don't know if she would agree that I do it enough. She's sitting right next to me right now, but I can check in with her and get back to you on that. But I think when you sink your teeth into this literature, it really does have an effect on your outlook, and you can't help but let it kind of change some of the way you approach relationships yourself.
David, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Rob. It's been a lot of fun.
That's David Craig. He's a doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at The Ohio State University. He talked with us about his research into gratitude and how other positive emotions can benefit our mental well-being. Still time to share your attitude when it comes to gratitude. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you make a conscious effort to thank people for things. Coming up, are you helping teach your kids while school doors remain closed? We'll want to hear how that's going, and we'll get some advice on what happens when parents become a little bit teachers for a while. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent welcomes Mystery Doug, host of a popular online science series for kids. Get answers to science questions and great ideas for learning at home activities. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Now, schools in Wisconsin are closed until at least April 24th under Governor Evers' Safer at Home order, but facilities can still be used for virtual or distance learning activities. The order has resulted in big changes for students, teachers, and parents. Many students are now learning through a computer or tablet and away from their classmates. Teachers are revising their lesson plans to better suit the virtual environment, and parents are getting more involved with guiding their kids through schoolwork while they work, in many cases, remotely themselves. Further complicating things, not everybody has high-speed internet access, and there are concerns that some students, in particular those with special needs, may be falling behind. Heather Hill is a professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. She focuses on teacher quality, teacher professional training, and instructional improvement. She's been writing about the coronavirus situation for Education Week. Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know schools all over the country are scrambling to deal with this situation. Can you talk about the range of approaches we're seeing around the country?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of different approaches, that's for sure. So I think the districts to date have been really concerned with getting kids online. So as you noted, about a quarter of kids don't have broadband access at home. And so the district's first order problem has been getting kids access to the internet so they can do whatever flavor of online learning is going to happen. But once that hurdle or that decision gets made, then districts are left with a lot of different options for how to roll this out. So they can do full-on online classes where kids get together with their teacher once a day and have synchronous kinds of conversations. Districts can post online assessments or online assignments where kids can be working at home under the supervision of their parents. And districts can also direct parents and kids to online learning environments like Khan Academy. So lots of decisions facing districts right now.
And I imagine we're in a pretty uncharted territory of how to do this right. I assume there's some research and we'll get into it, but in a lot of ways we're making up as we go. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. And the thing about districts is that school districts are really designed to do face-to-face learning and do it really well. So these aren't startup organizations that can turn on a dime. These are organizations that have been around for 100 years with the goal of getting kids into schools doing face-to-face instruction. So this is really unprecedented for districts to have to face.
I want to talk some about the role of the parent who, or guardian or grandparent, whoever may find themselves in this role of assistant teacher or tutor. You recently co-wrote a piece about this on possible ways that districts could help those parents and guardians fill that role. What do we know? What kind of things could help them out?
Right. So the first thing to know about this is that parents aren't going to replace teachers. All of the research says that kids learn best with teachers in schools. But that said, the research does point out some ways in which districts can help structure parents' time in such a way that they make the most of this time with their kids at home. So one of the big takeaways from this literature is that more structure for parents is better. So providing not only activities for kids, but some guidance for parents as to how to go about helping their kids do that activity is really important. Another piece of guidance is to make everything as simple as possible. So parents don't have a lot of time right now to be looking through a lot of instructions or, you know, hooking their kids up with crazy, brilliant science lessons. Simpler is better in this particular case. So for instance, there is a math program that is oriented around just having a kid do a math problem at bedtime. That's the level of simple at which we're talking at this point for a lot of parents and kids.
And volunteer tutors for schools, and it can make a difference. Just a little bit of training or a little bit of structure can make a big difference in the impact they have. Can we learn from that for our at-home parental tutoring?
Yeah, for sure. So that level of structure. So for instance, I'll give an example from a reading program. You know, if you're doing reading comprehension with kids and kids are reading a book, giving parents a simple set of questions that they can ask after any book that are comprehension questions that are easy to ask that are going to get kids engaged with thinking not only about what happened in the book, but why or what motivates this character. That level of a very simple set of questions that can be pulled out over and over as kids are reading books is really the sweet spot for helping parents do the work of working with their kids at home.
Talking to Heather Hill, professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, looking at what's going on with kids learning at home now, what districts are doing, how parents can help, and how we can make the most of this unusual time in American education. Heather, do you have thoughts on the best approach now for schools to take, and I imagine it might vary by age group, to make sure that that they are reaching kids and that kids are getting at least some kind of learning experience at home?
So I think the evidence would suggest, or the common sense would suggest, that more contact is better at this point. And the more touches that parents and teachers can have, especially with teachers saying, you know, here's some ways to work with the students, here's what we were working on, or here's what I'm planning on working on in terms of this assignment, here's a simple way that you can help, those touch points go far. Another component of this, though, is worrying about equity. So one of the things that we know is that parents who are better educated, who have higher incomes, and in this particular situation, also parents who have more flexible jobs and are also in the home more, are going to be advantaged over families who don't have those resources available to them. So districts saying, let's try to focus our efforts, let's get teachers more involved in the families that are needing more help, would also be a benefit at the time, at this time.
What are your thoughts on workload for kids? I've heard rumors that there are some places the approach is, hey, these kids have all the time on their hands, let's give them lots of stuff. Others saying, hey, let's not overwhelm people in this unusual situation where they're learning the technology, possibly. Where do you fall on that?
So this is a lose-lose situation for anyone who tries to make any kind of recommendation, but I'll give it a shot. You know, you have people saying, like, kids are so stressed, families are so stressed, leave them alone. And then you have people saying, but kids need structure and kids want to learn and families want their kids to learn. I think that the right answer to this is sensitive to the kid's age, actually. So there's decent amount of evidence that adolescents can do pretty well in online learning formats and sustain that for at least a few hours a day. I would not say that for kindergartners. I think kindergartners can't be in a, quote, online classroom for more than 30 minutes, nor would I think a kindergarten teacher want to necessarily control her classroom online for more than 30 minutes. And so districts really need to be really sensitive to the developmental needs of kids.
I want to talk about kids with particular educational needs. Here in Wisconsin, we have, I don't know if this is a national thing, what's called individualized educational plans. I know there's something like that everywhere. How can districts make sure that they don't get lost in the shuffle?
Yeah, this is a big one. And actually, we are working with a colleague on a column for EdWeek next week about this. The federal government has come out with guidance saying that the states can flex those plans right now, that usually these are very legally determined. Kids need a certain level of service, and the federal government has said, you know, you can flex this so that you're able to provide services to all kids. And not so much worry about these requirements right now. Many states, actually, to their credit, are trying to take up the challenge of supplying best case services to kids with special needs. And they're doing things like having IEP meetings over the phone, helping parents, giving special attention to parents to help train parents in how to provide the learning environment that their kids need. For instance, oftentimes kids with special needs need much more structured learning environments and need some of the stuff that's online. For instance, very conceptual instruction is not going to work out for kids with special needs. So really getting them funneled toward the resources, getting those families funneled toward the resources that can help those kids in particular.
We're talking about distance schooling amid the coronavirus pandemic. Heather Hill is with us, professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, a student, or a teacher, how is it going for you and the kids you work with? If you're a parent, how are you juggling the role of parents and maybe a little bit of tutor assistant? Advice you could share on how to make it work. If you're a teacher, how has the transition gone so far from the smiling faces, hopefully right there in front of you, versus they're out there, hopefully on a screen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Share your distance learning experiences as schools are shut down. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about how COVID-19 is affecting schooling. The pandemic has caused schools to shut down, so kids are trying to learn online. Parents are helping as much as they can. Schools are figuring out how best to educate kids when they're not in the building. Heather Hill is our guest. She's a professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Let us know how it's going at your home at 800-642-1234. What kind of work is being assigned to your kid or kids of whatever age? Is it going pretty smoothly so far? If you're a parent, are you helping or trying to help? What would help you to help? And if you're on the teaching end of things, definitely love to hear from you. How is it going? What kind of training, if any, did you get in the making the switch to going online? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Heather Hill, let me ask you about something I just brought up there, the idea of teachers being trained to make this switch. I know there wasn't a lot of time to do this. Do you have thoughts on how teachers can get help to make sure this works as well as it possibly can?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Obviously, there were not professional development programs for teachers teaching kids online prior to this. That said, there are in places and pockets in universities, for instance, University of Wisconsin-Madison, I'm sure has some guidance about how faculty members can teach online, which I think would be highly applicable to public school teachers as well. And a lot of districts also have in-house personnel who are instructional coaches, who are there, mentor teachers, things like that. They're there basically to help support teachers in any form of instruction that is going on. And I would think that that would be a great resource. Colleagues are great resources. But the bottom line is people are going to have to make this up as they go along and figure out how to do it and do it well.
So you, as an education researcher and your colleagues, are you trying to watch this in real time and as best we can measure it, at least in the short run?
I think people are thinking about how to do those studies, but I think right now people are all, especially in higher education, are still scrambling to put our own courses online, you know, and do everything else that folks are trying to do. So it's a great idea for a study, though. I think someone will do it.
Yeah. How is this working at the university level? I know you mostly, I think, focus on K through 12, but what are we seeing there with people meeting this challenge right now?
Yeah, so our university has done a great job of helping faculty go online. And, you know, there's different barriers to faculty going online, for everything from people really not knowing how to operate Zoom or Skype or any of those other meeting platforms, which is a pretty big one. If you're not comfortable with the technology, it's going to be much harder to teach, to faculty members who want to retain aspects of their course, which are harder to do online. So, for instance, I'm going to use my husband as an example. He teaches a discussion-based, he actually teaches middle school. He teaches a discussion-based math class. And so he's really had to think how to replicate that in an online setting where kids are all sitting in their bedrooms, but yet he still wants to have kids talking back and forth about math ideas or working on math problems together. So people are handling it fairly well, but I think we're just on this learning curve and it's very, very steep right now. I think in a few weeks or you know, hopefully by the fall, things should be worked out and online instruction should be a lot better.
And how can the parents make this work smoothly, bringing them back into the story now? You know, used mm-hmm. to be you ask your kids, do you have homework? And, you know, some schools have an online campus where you can check and see what your kids' schoolwork is now. Are there ways for parents to keep tab to make sure their kid is doing their virtual homework and discussion and whatnot?
Yeah, parents need to be in there with them in the Google Classroom or whatever online portal the schools are using to push out materials. Parents need to be much more attentive to the emails that are coming through from the school saying, okay, there's going to be an online session at this time where there's a face-to-face component. It's asking a lot more of parents, especially parents who are now used to their kids being pretty self-sufficient. So that would be, you know, late elementary through high school students. You know, there's quite a bit more supervision, you know, in particular for kids who may be less engaged in school and are, you know, have a harder time sticking with it and, you know, staying on top of things. This is a real challenge to those kids in particular, and parents need to really be in it with them.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in La Crosse. Brian, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. It's challenging, especially being a parent, because for those of us that are, you know, my wife and I are still considered essential, and thank God we got, you know, still have employment, but that just minimizes the amount of time that we're able to be home in order to help our kids. And fortunately, they're a little bit older. But even when you want to check and make sure that the kids' homework is getting turned in and on, you go on to the electronic or grade books, and only the stuff that gets recorded is what you know has been turned in. And you don't necessarily know if your kids turn stuff in. And the parents that have younger kids and are getting sent home packet after packet after packet, and they too are working, it's really challenging for them to find the time in order to be able to help their kids accomplish those tasks and get them in. And then internet access. If you do have patient or parents that are working from home and there's one computer, if you have multiple kids that are at home and they all need to somehow get access to the internet, then as my brother, who's a teacher, was told by his principal, the amount of workload down to a quarter, because there's a lot of factors that are going on inside the household that the world of education needs to be accepting of.
Brian, thank you so much for sharing your experience and your thoughts on that. Heather, what do you think of what Brian brought up there?
Yeah, I think Brian's right on, and I think he's not unusual right now among parents, where parents are essential or they're non-essential, but their jobs have not stopped because they can do their jobs remotely, and they're really struggling how to figure out how to keep their kids engaged in school, potentially off devices, playing games or whatnot, and feel like they can keep up. One thing that is helpful to me is just knowing that everyone is in the same boat at this point. So this is not an era when lots of kids are going to be learning tons and tons of stuff. but any learning right now is a bonus, I think. Hopefully your school district is flexible enough that none of this is required and kids are not being penalized for not making the transition or, you know, missing assignments or things like that. And the school district is also able to give some help. Reaching out to the teacher and talking with the teacher a little bit and trying to stay in communication with the teachers may help as well.
Thanks again for the call, Brian, at 800-642-1234. Heather Hill is with us from the Harvard Graduate School of Education, looking at schooling when kids can't go to school, how it's working, making those online connections, how parents can help out. Heather, eventually, hopefully, kids are going to go back to school. It may not be this school year. A lot of states have shut that down for now. How can students, kids, districts start to prepare for when they come back to school after this weird and difficult time?
Right. That's a great question. I think districts are going to, right now, I think districts are just totally swamped with making sure kids are getting assignments and everything is going as best it can. But within a month or two, districts are going to have to start to figure out what happens to that ninth grader who has missed a whole quarter of algebra. And what does that mean when they get to algebra two as a junior or as they continue on in physics, which requires a lot of algebra? So districts are really going to have to start to get groups of teachers who know the content really well and know the curriculum really well together to say, so what does that algebra two teacher do differently? Or what does the physics teacher do differently with the material that was missed in this particular spring? I'm a little less worried about topics like English language arts because some of that just loops back in the same content comes up over and over as grades progress or kids progress upwards in grades. And so that's a little bit more recoverable to me. It's more the material that becomes important for kids to know in later grades that I'm worried about.
I've heard at least some school districts are saying your grades can't get worse during this time. You're not going to be penalized. You can only help your grades. What do you think of that approach, taking some of the heat off?
I love that approach. You know, I think it's really hard to say to kids, especially kids in high school who are facing college application processes, that what's going on, like, you know, the learning that they're doing right now over the internet, which is imperfect. It's like version 1.0. of how you would do online learning at scale would matter for their college application or anything consequential. So I love that approach.
Time for one more quick call. Tammy is with us in Appleton. Tammy, hi.
Well, hello. How are you?
Good. Briefly, what did you want to tell us, Tammy?
Basically, I'd like to say that even though the kids aren't putting their nose in the books, there's a lot of life skills that are being taught inside the home. For example, cooking, cleaning, curtain. How can we stretch? You know, like you have four pieces of chicken, and how can we make five meals from that?
Tammy, thank you so much. We're just about out of time, but Heather, approaching different ways of learning at home, not just the school stuff, but looking for other learning opportunities.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea as well. So, especially if kids are interested in things like, you know, if you're out taking a walk around the neighborhood, learn about birds or learn about flowers. It's spring, you know, that kind of thing that is driven by what parents know and what parents feel comfortable teaching and the situations that they can engineer for kids that just improves everything overall for both families and kids learning.
Tammy, thanks for that call. And Heather, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. It was nice talking to you.
Heather Hill is a professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. We talked to her today about challenges and opportunities facing students, teachers, and parents as schools remain closed due to the coronavirus, with kids learning now online. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Wisconsin's top health official joins the show with a look at the state's latest efforts against COVID-19 and whether safer at home measures have helped slow the spread of the disease. We'll look at the prospects for expanded mail-in voting after Wisconsin's unusual election day in the midst of a pandemic. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're going to build a better breakfast sandwich. We'll get some recipes, and you can share some of your go-to favorites. And we'll ask the eternal question, runny egg yolk or no runny egg yolk? My answer is yes. All that and more, it's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, we'll find out how Wisconsin museums are coping during a time of shutdown, how they're sharing their services online, and what they're looking forward to when they reopen. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, how is the movie industry responding to the coronavirus pandemic? We talk to the real critic, Reggie Ponder. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.